You're listening to Sports Content Strategy with Mr. Richard Clark.
I'm David Tossell. I'm the author of One Day at a Time, The History of Limited Overs Cricket in 25 Matches. It's the 19th book I've had published, pretty even split between cricket and football. I'm a bit of a cricket tragic. I still play, umpire, watch, dream about cricket pretty much constantly.
How important in the history of cricket has one day cricket been? Because you're looking at it from the genesis of it 60 years ago, 60 years ago since the Gillette Cup started. But how important has one day cricket been? I know that's a big question to start with, but try and offer me some perspective there.
I mean, I think if you look at the history of the development of cricket in the last 60 years, it is entirely pretty much wrapped around the development of one day cricket in all its different forms. I mean, if you look at the 60 years before the first Gillette Cup in 1963, cricket was basically stayed the same. The game that they were playing in 1963 was pretty much the same game that W.G. Grace was playing at the turn of the century, 60 years earlier. Now, if you take it on 60 years from the advent of one day cricket and the Gillette Cup, we are looking at a completely different game. And all the developments pretty much have been around one day cricket. You know, first class cricket, test cricket, notwithstanding baseball, is pretty much the same game as it ever has been. All the changes have been around one day cricket and the way the game is presented, played, marketed, and the experience for the players these days as well, particularly.
As I said, 60 years since the Gillette Cup started, and that was the first county one-day competition. There had been elements of limited overs cricket before that, but just sum up what the mood was at the time and why there was a need for it.
There'd been, as football had experienced, there'd been a big sort of post-war boom in attendances at all live sport. You know, once the war finished in 45, everybody wanted to get back to live sport. So both football and cricket had experienced that boom for a while. The boom in cricket went away much more quickly than it did in football. So by the mid-50s, late 50s, it was clear that, you know, crowds were diminishing and there was an increasing desire amongst the cricket authorities to find a way to bring more people into the game, get more people into the stands. They kicked around the idea of some sort of knockout tournament. As early as during the war years, they thought it might be a good way to kind of reintroduce professional cricket after the war. But even then, they'd been talking about a first-class knockout tournament, a tournament of three-day matches. And it had eventually gone by the wayside. There was an issue of, well, what do we do if games are draws? Do we really need it? You know, people will come to the county championship anyway. So it had sort of gone on the back burner. But I mean, there had been talk, even as, you know, back in the previous century, of would it be nice to have a one day tournament? I mean, what I think a lot of people forget is that the essence of cricket on a sort of amateur level has always been one day cricket. It's always been, you know, two teams turning up on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon playing 40 or 50 overs or time games or whatever. So one day cricket wasn't an unknown beast, but it had never been done professionally. The thought was, let's try something new. We need to get more people in. We need to get more money into the game. Let's resurrect this idea that's been kicking around for years and see if we can do it. And it was a time of change generally in the game. I mean, it's probably no real coincidence that 1963, the first year of the Gillette Cup, was also the year that they abolished the whole gentleman and players demarcation. So cricket was in the mood for modernization, if you like. And the One Day Cup was the next obvious thing to trial.
And how much was money the motivation? I mean, you've talked about that, but how much was purely finances the motivation or the need to move the game on? Maybe that's an arbitrary split I'm making there. But in this period of time, I'm a big Essex fan, and that was a period of time where they were handing the bucket round at games to keep the county afloat. We were 20 years or so after the war. the mood was changing on from the war. The Beatles were coming up. The culture was changing. Was this a product of that feeling? I know you've talked about that, but just expand on the financial element of it.
I think it was largely driven by finances, but it's interesting. It was done almost quite naively, if you like. If they'd really seen this as a way to generate more money, they could have made more of it. So, for example, any knockout competition means that half the teams are gone after one game anyway, and whatever benefits they get through getting people through the gates is very short-lived. So maybe they, in those early days, could have looked at some kind of league thing where at least every team was going to be guaranteed a certain number of games. So I think it was financial. I don't think they looked at it as a development of the game as such. But the other element that they kind of overlooked, which was coming more into British sport at that time, was the sponsorship element. So they spoke to Gillette, and Gillette apparently went to them and said, okay, we're interested in this. How much do you want? And the answer for the MCC and Lords was, well, we just want enough to cover our costs. So, pay for the printing of the trophies and some advertising money and everything else. They didn't see this as something that was going to make a load of money for them. They just wanted to make sure they didn't lose money. The idea was that any additional income would be whatever they generated at the gate. They weren't looking for commercial rights. They weren't looking at TV money. So it was, in one way, it was kind of a modern way of thinking, but it was there was something kind of nicely naive about the whole thing. It's like they didn't want to appear to be too dirty or money grabbing, it would appear.
In the book, I think the first game you talk about is that first final, I think I'm right in saying. Mm. Was interest immediate? Did it spark interest immediate? Was it an immediate hit, or did it take time to grow?
It took a little bit of time. It's interesting watching and looking at the early reports of the games when reporters went along. I think I mentioned in the book that they almost treated it like a theatre review. They were actually kind of more interested in here's what the product is, here's how people are reacting to it. That was much more important than the who won the game and why, certainly in the early rounds. And I guess that's always been true. I mean, you look at the first 2020 games in 2003, it was very much the same. But I think that the interest certainly did grow and it did gain momentum. And you look at that first final, both teams brought lots of fans. Sussex and Worcestershire both brought lots of fans into London with them. And again, the reportage of the event was very much along the lines of FA Cup finals had been, with out of towners coming into London, and they weren't quite frolicking in the fountains in Trafalgar Square like you would see Newcastle United fans do at an FA Cup final. But it was very much treated in that manner. I think the momentum did gather probably more quickly than the authorities thought it would do, which was a pleasant surprise for them. And then it was the first time that they'd done an all ticket game at Lords, and it was pretty much sold out. So everything in that first year certainly justified their decision to introduce the tournament.
And there's a period 63 to I think 73 when the women had a World Cup in 50 yes. overs, and then 75 when the men had the first World Cup in 50 overs. So just talk about that period between 63 to 73, 75. How did the game evolve? Did rules change? Did the schedule change? How did it develop in those early years?
The first thing they did was, I think they realised that 65 overs, which they'd originally started the Gillette Cup for, was too many, and they reduced it down to 60. The other thing that happened was that the popularity of the tournament and the availability of Sundays in the schedule, both for the players and for broadcasters, encouraged people to look at, well, maybe there's more we can do with this. Maybe there's something in this, seeing a whole game of cricket in one day, you get a positive result. What can we do? And so a team called the International Cavaliers, who played a large part in the development of one-day cricket. They consisted of county players, overseas players, and they would sort of get together on Sundays and play games against the various counties. the popularity of one day cricket was such that ITV were able to BBC were able to take a look at this, and Hugh Weldon, who was the head of BBC Two at the time, went to his bosses and said, "You know, we've got a product here that could fill a few hours on a Sunday afternoon. We can see through the Gillette Cup that one day cricket is popular. Let's get it on our screens." The challenge they had was fitting it into a broadcast time slot. They wanted it to go from 2 to 6:30. So the overs went down to 40. It was Ted Dexter, who captained Sussex to the first couple of Gillette Cup wins, who had the idea of, let's limit bowlers' run-ups to 15 yards so that we can make sure that we get the game in time. And those games proved really popular. And there was obviously nothing at stake, but people loved seeing a positive result. They loved the way the games were played. They saw the star players. And that then triggered the next development, which was the counties looking and saying, well, hang on, why are we letting a third party basically have the scene to themselves on a Sunday afternoon? Why don't we do something? Why don't we start a competition for the counties, a league game where, you know, 8 home games a year, 16 games a season, we can fill those schedules ourselves. And BBC, not surprisingly, said, great, you know, that sounds good. That's even better than what we've got at the moment. We'll cover it. And that was the advent of the John Player League, which launched in 69. So for a few years, you know, county cricket was getting a higher profile on broadcast than it ever had done. There was now, you know, every Sunday afternoon, people were watching county games. There was the Benson Hedges Cup wasn't too far away. Again, you know, the TCCB looked at the popularity of one-day cricket and thought, okay, how can we get more? And they introduced the Benson Hedges Cup in 72, which started as a early season regional competition going into knockout. So by the early 70s, you've got 3 one-day tournaments, all on live TV, all bringing in good money. And the International Cavaliers obviously had gone by the wayside in the meantime. But I think that the groundwork that they laid for that period when there was so much one-day cricket on TV, it shouldn't be underestimated.
You can find Sports Content Strategy on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, or go to sportscontentstrategy.com. Richard is at Mr. Richard Clark on all social media. Read his blog and sign up for his newsletter at mrrichardclark.com.
And if we go to that first World Cup, I mean, one of the niceties, the looking back on it, not niceties, but very, very English approach to it, in that we had players batting as though it was a test match, it seems. It's certainly in comparison to the way they approach one-day cricket now. It's interesting because I'd argue that baseball is one-day cricket transferred to test cricket.
Yes.
What we had then was test cricket transferred to one-day cricket. Is that a surprise? I mean, it strikes me as a surprise that there wasn't that amount of playing innovation, because T20 came along. And like fielding, for example, has gone absolutely stratospheric in the last 10 years of T20, and the fielding is ridiculously good, but the scoring rates and the batting didn't seem to evolve in that 63 to sort of 75 period, or am I seeing it wrong? But that's certainly
no. I think you're right. I think one thing that did evolve quickly, and that was largely down to Ted Dexter at Sussex, was field placings. Dexter was one of the people who very quickly realised that you don't need 2 slips in a gully for a whole 60 overs, that you can push players back onto the boundary. And, you know, Sussex famously received a complaint from the Kent committee in their first Gillette Cup match. They thought this was very unsporting that Ted Dexter put people on the boundary. So field placement had evolved. But you're right, that was pretty much the only thing that did. So as far as bowlers were concerned, I've spoken to a few who played in those early games. It was still very much hit the top of off stump, be consistent in your line and length. The theory was that the captains felt that if you're consistent in your line and length, then the batsman can only play a certain number of shots, so therefore we can set the field for it. And that was true. So the bowlers didn't need to come up with all the different innovations they have now with sort of slower ball bouncers and you know, even the number of Yorkers that, that they try and bowl. It was hit at the top of off stump. We know the batsmen are not going to innovate. You know, you get some, you had some players who, you know, like a Clive Lloyd, for instance, who was just instinctively and naturally a fantastic one-day player, just because of the way he played the game in general, not because he made any great effort to make himself a great one-day player. It just suited the kind of player he was. But you're right, it was largely, let's bat through the first 15, 20 overs, not lose any wickets, and we'll try and have a slog at the end. And even as late, as you say, as the first World Cup, which was 12 years after one-day cricket had been introduced, particularly the countries that didn't play that much, like Australia, for example, their approach to that first World Cup was exactly that. Ian Chappell told his batsmen, let's get through the first 15 or 20, not lose any wickets, and then have a slog. I spoke to Ross Edwards about it, and he said that they had no preparation at all. That first World Cup, they were coming out for the World Cup and then staying on for an Ashes series. The Ashes series was where 100% of the focus was. They had a bit of a slog in the nets just as a practice, and that was it. They weren't expecting to do anything in the World Cup, and they weren't really bothered whether they did or not. So you're right, that the game really stayed still for many years, and even beyond that first World Cup, to be honest. I mean, look at the second World Cup final, England chasing a big total against the West Indies, and Boycott and Brearley batted through, I think, about 30 overs for about 120 and effectively lost England the game. So it did take a long time to catch up. And that's why I write in the book about the famous 1971 Gillette Cup semi-final, when David Hughes came in for Lancashire and hit 24 off an over. It wasn't even the last over. It was, you know, four or five overs to go, hit 24 in an over. And that was, you know, apart from the fact that it was on live on TV, it was like headline news because no one went out, hit 24 in an over. Now it's, you know, it's commonplace. You get 24 in an over, you know, every game at some point. So, it was very much a slow evolution.
And how important was it that certainly the Gillette Cup, and to a certain extent the B&H, if memory serves, certainly for the Gillette Cup, felt FA Cup final-ish, but also you had the minor counties involved, you know, and taking the game out to the Bedfordshires, the Hertfordshires, the Cumbrias, the Durhams at the time, you know, for example. How important was that for the growth of the game?
I honestly don't get the impression that that was a particularly important driver. I think the having around when the minor counties played in the Gillette Cup and having a sort of minor counties north and a minor counties south in the B&H was more a question of expediency. It allowed the Gillette Cup to expand to an extra round. It meant that, you know, the first class counties got another game to play because the minor counties were, in the most cases, sort of convenient fodder for that first round. It rounded out the Gillette Cup, the Benson Hedges Cup to sort of 20 teams. So it kind of made it a little bit more manageable. So I think it was more a question of, you know, pragmatism rather than we can use these tournaments to spread the game. I don't think the powers that be at Lords were thinking in that way at all. I think it was just purely from a practical point of view.
The Sunday League, the coverage on the BBC going back and forth and back and forth through Sunday Grandstand, for example, that seemed to be culturally so important to the growth of the game. So many people talk about, well, I remember players like Stuart Turner and Colin Dredge, who were not stars of the show, but for a Sunday afternoon, they were the star of the show. And so many people still talk about those as halcyon days for county cricket. And it's the usual sort of right product pushed on television, right time, etc. Am I being romantic there, or is there a have you got stats to support that or something?
No, I don't think you are. I think it's a fact of we were in an era when there were three TV channels, and if you're sitting there on a Sunday afternoon, and you're someone that's got a, you know, an interest in sport, and it's the summer, what else are you going to do? What else are you going to watch? You've got, you know, probably an old Western on BBC One and a Golden Shot or something on ITV, and then you've got live sport on BBC Two, and it happened to be county cricket, and therefore it gathered an audience. And you're like, people like Stuart Turner and Colin Dredge did become sort of well known. And it's interesting you mentioned those two guys, because the success of people like that was one of the negatives, if you like, that the naysayers about one day cricket kind of pointed to. That, you know, a lot of people who didn't like one day cricket, the real dyed in the wool traditionalists, who felt that one day cricket was going to diminish the skills of the really fast bowlers because they had to come in off 15 yards, and it was going to take spinners out of the game because they were going to get slogged into the car park. The success of people like Stuart Turner and Colin Dredge was kind of ammunition for them. They would say that this is exactly the type of player who shouldn't be the most important on a cricket field. It should be the fast bowlers and the spinners and the big hitters. But the fact that you've got your dibbly dobbly merchants who dropping it there and bowling eight overs, you know, 2 for 24 every Sunday is not what, you know, the game should be about. But you're right, it did make, you know, household names in a sense of some of those people. But I think it was a combination of those factors, and you know, Sunday afternoon, captive audience, and it was compelling stuff as well. I mean, the interesting thing, if you look at it now, you can make a very good comparison with scores in the John Player League with, you know, the IPL, for example. It was all, you know, John Player League. If you got 175, 185, that was a decent score. You know, getting 200 was kind of unusual. And it's very much the same as it is in the IPL now in half the number of overs. Interestingly, it takes pretty much the same amount of time now as well. An IPL innings takes pretty much two hours in the same way the old John Player League innings, you know, took just over 2 hours. They didn't. They weren't stopping for strategic timeouts during the 40
or,
over,
or advert breaks, as they actually are. So there we
indeed,
go.
Indeed. Yeah.
But I mean, talking about that, because I'm looking through your list of games, and as I say, we're moving on from domestic English cricket here. But I'm looking at, for example, the England South Africa game, World Cup semi 92 Sydney, where the rain delay, and South Africa are left with 22 needed. That was what ripple effects did situations such as that in major games have to the format of one day cricket overall? Because, you know, moments like that are very memorable because it was ridiculous. I mean, I'm not sure if that did that directly lead to Duckworth Lewis or
absolutely, yeah, 100%. Yeah, so it was completely the catalyst for Duckworth Lewis, which has become, you know, such a key part of one day cricket now, in all its forms. The situation of that World Cup was that they wanted to not do average run rate. Everyone realized that just doing it on average run rate, if there was rain delays, was unfair, because it didn't take any account of the situation of the game. So it was Richie Beno who came up with the most productive overs format formula, which basically meant that if you batted for 50 overs and then it rained and the next team was only going to bat for 40, they had to match what you'd scored in your 40 most productive overs, which sounds okay in theory, but when you look at it in practice, it meant that if in scoring 300, you'd actually batted out 10 maiden overs along the way, those 10 maiden overs got taken off, and then the team batting second is then looking at scoring 300 in 40 overs. Which still isn't too bad if you know that that's the only rain you're going to get, and you start the second innings knowing exactly what you've got to score and it's not going to change. What the England-South Africa semi-final brought to life was the problems if you got further rain or you got rain during an innings. So South Africa needed 22 off 13 balls. It rained for 10 minutes, which basically meant they had to lose two overs. And this was all because of the TV companies were very rigid in their time schedule. So the overs had to be bowled in a particular amount of time. So losing those 10 minutes meant they lost two overs. And England, South Africa, as you would expect, had bowled a couple of maiden overs. So they got taken out of the equation. So it was still 22 runs to win, but it was now one ball. And everyone realised that that was a crazy situation. Frank Duckworth, who was a mathematician and statistician, had already written to the cricket authorities, the TCCB, with a formula even before this. And this kind of gave him fresh impetus to speak to people again. There was such an outrage about what happened that there was a much more open mind when it came to looking at this kind of thing now. And he, together with Tony Lewis, not the Tony Lewis, another Tony Lewis, refined their theories. And within a couple of years, the ICC had adopted it and decided to use it in all major one-day cricket. As we know, it kind of takes account of resources, how many overs you've got left, how many wickets you've got left. And even though people still don't necessarily like it 100%, and I don't think anyone could actually explain the mathematics of it, I think people understand the theory but couldn't actually do the maths involved. It's still, you know, what, 20, 30 years later, no one's come up with anything better. And it really was that game that made sure that that came in. Because you couldn't have another situation like we'd had. It was, you know, it was farcical.
I'm just looking down your list of games. Certainly Pakistan's World Cup win is in there. I think India's is in 83 as well. I think I'm right.
Yeah, India's in 83 is more standalone than Pakistan's in 92. I think India's win in 83, I think everybody would acknowledge that was a fundamental change in the game. India had very much been a test playing cricket, test playing nation. You know, England would tour there and they'd be at day five of a test match in Calcutta with only, you know, one wicket to take, and you'd still get 50, 60,000 people show up there. But the win in 83 suddenly brought people alive to the possibility of what one day cricket could be, what you know, the excitement it generated. India suddenly were world champions in something which, you know, hadn't happened in anything really other than sort of Olympic hockey. So it gave the nation itself a great sense of pride. And this was something they wanted to carry on. And so suddenly one day cricket became the big thing in India. And with the opening up of the TV markets there as well, it not only did you have a format of cricket that people were falling in love with, you had TV companies who were falling over each other to pay big money for it. And that really was the start of the whole shift of the economics of the world game. That win in 83, I think without that, you know, we probably wouldn't be having some of the conversations that we're having about one day cricket in general. Interesting, I didn't pick the final itself as the match I focused on to tell the story. I actually used a one-day international in Guyana a couple of months earlier where India had beaten West Indies for the first time. And that was sort of the game that, in a sense, gave them the belief that they could actually compete with the big boys. And they went beat West Indies twice in the World Cup in a group game and in the final. So I felt that was an important game to acknowledge along the way.
You could have even done was it Zimbabwe at Tunbridge Wells?
The Zimbabwe game. Yeah, interestingly,
wasn't it?
Yeah, that was another one. The interesting thing about that is that I think people forget that as important a win as it was at the time, the way that the other results went that day, the result of that game didn't, in the end, make all the difference. If they'd lost to Zimbabwe, they still would have been relying on what happened in their final game against Australia to determine whether they got to the semi-finals or not. Now, whether they would have then beaten Australia if they'd suffered the ignominy of losing to Zimbabwe is debatable. And it was a phenomenal innings. The sad thing about that is that there's no film record of it anywhere. It wasn't one of the games that was scheduled for live coverage. Because back in those days, you know, you'd have four games played on the same day. BBC would cover two of them, two would go uncovered. And there was a BBC news strike on at that time. So there wasn't even a news camera down in Tunbridge Wells to film any of it. So I've heard a little bit of radio commentary of it, and that's about it. It's a shame because it is, by all accounts, you know, one of the great innings with Kapil Dev getting his team from 17 for five to 280 odds. So yeah, fantastic.
But for the first mover advantage that 50 over cricket has with regard to the World Cup, would 50 over cricket still exist given what's happened with T20?
I think you can make a very strong argument that it wouldn't. If T20 had been invented first, it's very difficult to see a scenario where someone would have said, do you know what, we should have a 50-over tournament as well. 50 overs or 60 overs, it was originally, filled a need at the time. It was a way to get people into the cricket grounds to see a match that would finish in one day, which was, you know, thought to be the way that you could popularise the game. Now that they've found a way to get it into one evening, I can't see a scenario where anyone would have said 50 over international cricket or county cricket is what we need. And I think you're right. It is hanging on in there simply because, in a sense, having been sort of the new boy on the block in 1963, it's now kind of part of the establishment, if you like. 50 over World Cup continues because it has become part of cricket tradition, and happily, certainly when the World Cups come around, is still a magnificent event that people take really seriously, and it captures the imagination, as we saw 4 years ago. But I think you're right. It is simply because it was the first mover advantage. I would love to think that it would stay around forever, because I'm a massive fan of 50 over cricket. But we know the schedule's getting squeezed, and what gets squeezed more than anything seems to be 50 over cricket, doesn't it? We've seen it with the One Day Cup now in England. You look at the footage of games in the 60s and 70s, with the crowds there. And it's interesting comparing crowds at those games with Test cricket at the same time. So if you look at, Lancashire playing in a cup semi-final in the early 70s, and then you look at the Test match at Old Trafford a few days later, there's just no comparison in the size and the vibrancy of the crowd. Lancashire, I'm using it as an example, was almost like the first Barmy Army. The Lancashire cricket crowd of the late 60s and early 70s was the first time that football crowds had really sort of been seen at cricket grounds. It was, chanting, and, it was everything that football had. And Test cricket, you look at footage from the early 70s, half-empty grounds, very polite applause, very slow and sedate. It was the one day crowds that had the vibrancy.
You can find Sports Content Strategy on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Go to sportscontentstrategy.com for more information and to sign up to the newsletter. Richard is at Mr. Richard Clark on all social media. Read his blog at mrrichardclark.com.
So, what was the need? Perceived need that led to the creation of T20 cricket? Because if the World Cup was doing okay and the 50 over was what we had, what was the identified need that said, okay, we need this new thing? It must have been waning in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think one day cricket had its peak, if you like. One day cricket during the 90s had been diminishing in popularity. The Benson Hedges Cup in particular was sort of hanging on by its fingernails. The attendance at the group games in particular was minimal. And I think county cricket found itself in the position that it had been in, 40 years earlier, where we needed to do something to get more people in. And rather than just kind of doing it on a gut feel, which they'd probably done in 63, this time it was a little bit more scientific. There was, focus groups done at the TCCB and or the ECB as it was by then. And it was determined that a game that people could potentially go to after work, after school, could see it in 3 or 4 hours, was the next logical step. And I think that's what it was. It was the next logical step. And I made the point in the intro to the book, it seems that whenever cricket wants to make itself more popular, the answer is to offer less of it, to make the game shorter and more consumable, I guess. Don't forget, by the early 2000s, we were already moving into a world where people's attention spans were getting shorter. There was much more competition for people's time, and even spending 6 hours at a cricket ground was beyond a lot of people. And that's what the data turned up. They decided that, you know, they could get a lot more people into the grounds if they gave them a short game. And that's the genesis of 2020. You know, I spoke to some players who played it. You know, and again, where we mentioned earlier that 50 over cricket was not something that was unknown, nor was 20 over cricket. You know, we all as schoolboy cricketers grew up playing 20 over cricket. And I think, you know, professionally, they quite like the idea of being able to do that, especially if it was going to mean they could be performing in front of large crowds, and particularly at the smaller counties. I mean, it's interesting. I spoke to Ian Ward, who said at Surrey they were a bit sniffy about it, and the members were a bit sniffy about it, and the players who were used to playing on a big stage weren't too sure about it. And then someone like Charles Dagnall, who was at Leicestershire, said we're all over it. We loved it. The idea of suddenly, you know, Leicestershire were going to be playing in front of big crowds on TV, in a competition that we felt we could probably win, we were all over it. So I think, yes, it was the next logical step in this sort of progression of making the game shorter and more consumable.
T20 became popular relatively quickly. How did 50-over cricket respond? You know, what rule changes did 50-over cricket bring in as a result of 2020? Or did it do nothing? Did it go the other way?
I'm not sure it was necessary because of 2020, but I think 50-over cricket had started struggling with the middle overs, if you like. They had the used to be the 15-over power play where you could only have two men outside the circle, and you know, and then that was it. You could do what you wanted pretty much for the rest of the game. Or you could only have five outside the circle, but it was then constant, and they were finding that middle overs, people would knock the ball around singles, and it was only in the last 10 that they were going for it. So I think what 2020 did probably was highlighted the need to make 50 overs a game where batsmen were going to go for it for a longer period of time. I mean, if all they were going to do was hit out for the first 15 and then hit out for the last 5 or 10, well, you might as well just go and watch the 2020 game, because you've got nothing to excite you in the middle of the game. So that's why they tinkered around for various years with power plays and the floating power play where the batting team could choose where they wanted it. And I think they seem to have hit on a formula that works pretty well now with the sort of the gradual change from after the first few overs, and then for the last 10, you've got, you know, more men allowed out. But I think the other thing that has changed is that batting teams have realised that actually knocking the ball around in the middle overs doesn't work anymore anyway. And I think what T20 has proved is that you actually can go for it all the time. You know, people now, because they've trained for T20 cricket and they know they've got to clear the boundary, you've got number six batsmen coming in a 50-over game, you know, after 25 overs, and they're going for it straight away. They're not thinking, right, let's just knock the ball around for 20 and go for it in the last five. So I think not only has T20 brought in a few tweaks of the rules, I think it's basically just changed the mindset of batters and batters realise that it is actually possible to go for it for longer. And so 50-over cricket has probably benefited. I mean, you look at the scores in 50-over cricket now, there's no comparison to where it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And that's with, you know, rule changes that have sort of tried to restrict scoring. So I think, it, you know, 2020 cricket probably has had a beneficial effect on 50-over cricket. Now, whether it's a benefit that's going to keep 50-overs cricket going for another 50 years is a question we'll all wait and find out.
Yeah, that's where I'm going, really. Because if you look at the English schedule, well, we won the thing 2019, and a load of our players have barely played it since.
Yeah.
Because they're not playing in the domestic tournament, because they're playing either 100 cricket or 2020 cricket. And that's seen as a stick to beat the ECB with. I'm not against that quite a lot of the time. That said, What are they supposed to do?
Yeah.
What are they supposed to do to keep this competition vibrant, keep it going? Is it worth it? What's its future? Is there a path that it can take, given that, you know, certainly from my perspective, there's 20 of a 50 overs game, 20 overs of it, it's pretty staid. And as a product, I see 2020 and Test cricket as every ball is important for different reasons. You know, yes, for the slow cadence, for the fast cadence, every ball is important. And I don't quite get that with 50-50, whether I'm, sorry, with 50 overs. Rightly or wrongly, I just get there's a 20-over period where it's drifting. And I can't, and that's not acceptable.
And the other thing now, because of the way they've set the schedule with the 100 taking up the same period of time pretty much, you can't even argue that this is an opportunity for our players to get 50 over experience with a view to playing in the England team. Because I think if we look at this year's One Day Cup, and then in 5 years' time, maybe look at the number of players who have played in this year's One Day Cup that have gone on to play 50 over cricket for England, it's probably going to be minimal, because all the players that are likely England players are going to be in the 100 anyway. So you don't even have it as a development tool to kind of bang the drum about. So it is sad. I mean, in terms of 50 over cricket in general, the obvious key is going to be TV, and whether, you know, as long as Indian TV companies still want to broadcast Indian One Day cricket, which they probably will, that is basically what's going to, you know, drive the whole thing. If, you know, if India's still playing it, there's still a lot of money to be made in 50 over cricket for TV companies and for cricket boards. You know, if we're playing a One Day series against India, we know we can make money out of it because the Indian broadcasters are going to want the rights. Maybe that's going to kind of keep 50 over international cricket going along in between the World Cups. But it's difficult because I know people say, well, as long as the World Cup keeps going, but if there's no 50 over cricket of any significance in between World Cups, then you sort of, it clearly devalues the 50 over World Cup in itself, because players won't have been playing it. A lot of people would have just gone and been playing T20. You know, what is the cachet of the 50 over World Cup going to continue if that is the only 50 over cricket that exists? And that's a big question.
That, and the other thing, of course, in order to grow the game, well, we've been looking at cricket in the Commonwealth Games. It was in last time. Cricket in the Olympics is a possibility. Taking the game around the world, it's quicker. Presumably, it's less expensive, but certainly it fits into formats if it's a shorter game. You can't do that with Test cricket, and you can't do it with 50 over cricket. I mean, I'm not sure you can do it with 2020 cricket with regard to the Olympics. That's considered too long, I think I'm right in saying.
Yes.
It might have to be T10. I mean, that might be the way forward. At what point, with the reduction, and you said, you know, cricket grows by offering less of it. So at what point does it stop being cricket? You know, because if it's going to T10 and that exists as a thing, and you could argue that would work in the TV schedules and it would work in the Olympics, and, you know, and these are good things.
I think the beauty of cricket is that it is always cricket. I mean, I think one of the beauties of cricket is that it is a sport that lends itself to multiple different formats and is still cricket, even if it's not the cricket you grew up with or the cricket that you love, it is still cricket. In the same way that I guess, you know, the LIV Golf Tour would say that, you know, 54 hole tournaments is still golf, and, you know, even if it's down from 72, at least cricket as a sport allows itself to shrink and expand or do whatever it wants. You know, if you had to invent a new form of football, it probably wouldn't be football. You'd be, I don't know, bigger goals, or I don't know, whatever you might do. But cricket is, at least, and that's one of the beauties of cricket, is a game that can be all thing to all people. And if you've only got time for a turnover game, you know, and you know, we all played different formats when we were kids, and you know, in the park or whatever, you could find a way of playing it with four or five of you. That is the beauty of cricket. Maybe that's what saves it, and maybe that's what kills it in the end. You know, maybe it's I don't know. I would love to think that all forms of cricket have a future. But you're right, it is very difficult. I mean, you know, we talked about, would you invent 50 overs now? You probably wouldn't. You certainly wouldn't, if you were starting cricket from scratch, you certainly wouldn't think of first-class cricket, would you? I mean, who's going to come up with a sport that goes for 4 or 5 days and you don't get a result at the end of it? At least with golf, you know, you've got 4 days of a tournament, you have a winner at the end, but you're not always guaranteed that with cricket. So, I don't know, it's such a difficult conundrum. I do feel sorry for the people who are charged with coming up with schedules that can meet so many different needs, you know, broadcasters' needs, players' needs, the need to grow the game. I mean, it is pretty much got to a state where it's going to be impossible to fulfill all of those things in future years. So something has got to go. Either the fans or the broadcasters or the players or the growth of the game is going to miss out somewhere. You just can't do everything, I don't think.
Last one. Let's throw ourselves forward 30 years and say, having been 50 overs, having been the number one format in, say, the early 70s, is now the number four format because T10 has come in at number three, for example. If it is not extinct, but rarely played and relatively irrelevant, what will its legacy to cricket have been?
I think its legacy will be that it was the starting point for everything that will still be around in 30 years. I think we wouldn't have got to 2020 if we hadn't had 50 overs. Well, maybe we would have done eventually, but you know, it's everything progresses in a certain sequence, doesn't it? And in cricket's case, it needed 60 over cricket as it was, 65 overs as it was, to introduce the idea to the powers that be that cricket could succeed in a shorter format and could be, if you like, a saviour of the sport, certainly at sort of domestic county level in England. So I think without that, we wouldn't have naturally got to where we are. Or maybe we would. You know, if one day cricket had never been invented, maybe they would have sat there in the early 2000s and said, you know, we need something. And as we said earlier, it wouldn't have been 50 over. Maybe they would have gone straight to 20 over cricket. But I think the other thing we would have missed, the big part of the legacy that we would miss would have been all the fantastic cricket that we've seen over 60 years in one day cricket. You know, that the first World Cup final, the England beating New Zealand at Lord's, Viv Richards playing magnificent innings at Old Trafford, you know, people like Chris Gayle and Sachin Tendulkar playing not only good big hitting innings, but over a period of time. I mean, a great 2020 innings is fantastic, but it doesn't match seeing Sachin Tendulkar bat all day to score 200 in a 50-over game. And maybe that is the biggest legacy, is just those memories, those matches, and the way that we've been able to see some fantastic players and some fantastic games over the years. Maybe we always would have got to 2020 somehow. But doing it the way it's happened, with all those fantastic games in the meantime, has been a fantastic way to get there.
Yeah, so you're saying almost there's an inverse relationship. As cricket becomes shorter, which is natural, it also becomes more disposable and less meaningful. Less meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think when in the early days of 2020, the thing I didn't like about it was because it had no history. There was no real individual storylines. There was no context. 2020 has now been going so long that it's created its own context, if you like. And, you know, particularly when you look at the way 2020 has evolved from a strategic and tactical point of view. It has much more of that element to it than probably 50 over cricket does. And that gives it a sort of another strand of sort of storytelling, if you like. And, you know, the players who go around and win tournaments at various different teams, you know, they create their own sort of personal storyline. So in a sense, T20 has created its own narrative because it's now been around for so long. And that was the element I felt was missing from it in the early days, in the same way that people who are watching the early Gillette Cup probably thought this doesn't mean anything because the guy scores 100, what does it really matter? But, you know, 20 years later, if a guy's scoring his 50th one day 100, it actually is, you know, that's quite an achievement and quite a feat and quite a story. So I think 2020 has created its own narrative over the years. But I think, yeah, we certainly, I would have missed all the narrative of one day cricket as 50, 60 overs over the years if we'd never had it.
David Tossell, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You can find Sports Content Strategy on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Go to sportscontentstrategy.com for more information and to sign up to the newsletter. Richard is at Mr. Richard Clark on all social media. Read his blog at mrrichardclark.com.